This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm really thrilled to be here today to participate in this celebration of the semi-centennial of the amazing fossil that we all know with unique intimacy as Lucy. And that's not simply because at the time of her discovery, Lucy was by far the most complete skeleton of an early hominin that had ever been discovered. And because as such, she gave us such unprecedented insight into the characteristics of the very earliest bipedal hominins. But it's also because I'm old enough to remember what life was like before Lucy. And it was a very different world from the one we're familiar with and sort of take for granted today. For one thing, back then, paleoanthropologists were still quite freshly in shock from a very powerful assault that had been launched upon them by this man here, the ornithologist and the evolutionary theoretician, Ernst Mayr. In the summer of 1950, and in what was probably the most influential single speech ever given in paleoanthropology, Mayr had addressed a gathering of paleoanthropologists and evolutionary biologists and geneticists at the prestigious Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island. And in no uncertain terms, he had told this elite audience that they were completely wrong to have believed that the human past had been populated by this long list of extinct genera and species we see here. Well, so far so good, because he really did have an excellent point there. But then he went on to declare that in contrast to that jumble of taxa we just saw, the entire story of human evolution had instead consisted of this supremely simple linear progression. A progression that, moreover, had taken place only within the single genus Homo. Even worse, Mayr claimed that within that unique lineage, there had existed a mere three species, and that each of those species had sort of lost its identity as it gradually evolved into the next one in the series. And that, of course, meant in turn that these constantly changing species could not, even in principle, be the visually recognizable units that paleontologists have to depend on as their basic units of analysis. So you might have thought that at least the paleontologists in Mayr's audience would have pushed back a bit against this nihilistic attack on their science by someone who had likely never even seen a hominid fossil in his life. But in the event, and for very complicated reasons, nearly all of the paleoanthropological establishment immediately capitulated, pretty much instantaneously, to Mayr's attack. And indeed, so traumatized were these guardians of the human fossil record that for over a decade, barely anybody in the business even dared to refer to a species name in print, preferring to just refer to individual fossils when they were talking about the human fossil record. Well, so profound was the effect of Mayr's assault that some 14 years passed in this sort of post-crisis paralytic mode before things began to open up again. And that opening came in 1964, when these wise men, three wise men, Louis Leakey and Philip Tobias and John Napier, added the new species Homo habilis to the hominin roster. Now, at a time when the range of morphologies known in the hominin past was about to blossom, you might have thought that this addition to the genus Homo would actually turn out to be quite helpful. But actually, it really wasn't, because it wasn't made in the context of any coherent attempt to make sense out of the steadily increasing range of hominin morphologies. Instead, the tendency was to try to continue to force them into continuous lineages. And that was a real issue because, in fact, Homo habilis had been named in the spirit of Louis Leakey's romantic belief in the then popular notion of man, the toolmaker, and of course in the service of his very personal quest for the manufacture of the very early stone tools that he and his wife Mary were finding at Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge. So while the new species of Homo habilis in 1964 did create a little bit of extra taxonomic elbow room among the hominins, it really was not in the long run very useful systematically. But both soon and inevitably, the sheer pressure of accumulating discoveries began to point out very painfully how threadbare Meyer's linear scheme actually was. And for example, in retrospect, it's pretty easy for us to see that by the time the 1970s came around, Richard Leakey's discoveries in the Turkana Basin of northern Kenya were already turning up an altogether unanticipated range of hominid morphologies in the African Pliocene. Now, at this point, I feel I really must make a big shout out to the Leakey family in all its generations, because they have truly, truly made a monumental contribution to paleoanthropology. But nonetheless, because Meyer had driven paleoanthropology into that strictly minimalist mindset, all new Turkana Basin fossils were assigned to the genus Homo unless they were robust Austrapiths of the kind you see at the top right and top center in this picture here. And for several years, and for reasons that are still not entirely clear, it was strictly against policy at Turkana to assign non-robust hominins to any particular species at all. And I would blame that on the lingering influence of Ernst Meyer. And finally, when it did become okay to give larger brain Turkana fossils like the ones that we see at the top here a species identity, the name chosen was Homo erectus. Even though that name actually belonged to the Javan fossil you see at the bottom of this image here, which was almost a million years younger than the African forms, had been found on the opposite side of the world from them, and had precious few morphological similarities in common with them. So just to summarize, in the early 1970s, establishing a solid systematic framework for the hominins was not a general priority for paleoanthropologists. And that, I think, made it particularly fortunate that business was done rather differently by the scientists who were working at Hadar in northern Ethiopia, which was, of course, where Don Johansson and his colleagues began making their extraordinary stream of discoveries in 1973, and where Lucy herself turned up in 1974. Now, as you can all recall, there was a lot of initial debate about how to interpret the large range of particularly size that was encountered in this assemblage. But by 1978, a defensible decision had been arrived at to include all of them in the single new species, Australopithecus afarensis, which of course was exemplified by Lucy herself. And as we can see depicted in this 1979 diagram, the new species was considered to be ancestral both to the later South African Australopithecines on the one hand and to the later Homo lineage on the other. And the key thing about this hypothesis here was not whether it was right or whether it was wrong, but that once it had been settled upon, a point of reference had been established. a point of reference both for the rational discussion of the species diversity that existed in the African prior Pleistocene record, and for determining the relationships among the species that were represented. So there really was a very profound difference between the Hadar and the Turkana scientists in their approaches to the hominin record and to the questions they were asking about it. The Turkana group represented the traditional paleoanthropological distrust of systematics, while the Hadar folks differed in being explicitly interested in identifying the species that they had to hand and in establishing the relationships among those species. And I think that difference was never more dramatically on display than it was in 1981 at a famous debate between Don Johanson and Richard Leakey that was nationally televised from the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. With the legendary newsman Walter Cronkite as the mediator, Don and Richard took to the stage to expound upon the significance of the respective hominin fossil finds that they had made. And after some initial pleasantries, the sparring began in earnest. And eventually, Don reached under his chair and brought out this chart here. And as you can see, it bore Don's published phylogeny on one side against a timescale. And on the other side was just a blank timescale. Well, of course, you could see immediately what was just about to happen. And Don handed Richard a marker pen and challenged him to write in his own theory of relationships in the blank area on the chart. And of course, Richard was somewhat nonplussed by all of this. And he thought about this kind, collegial invitation for a minute or two. And then he reached forward and he brusquely crossed out the family tree, as you can see on the left in this image here. And when he was asked what he would replace it with, he wrote in not an alternative family tree, because after all, he wasn't even interested in having one. He instead wrote in the large question mark that you see on the right. And I think that question mark perfectly symbolized the traditional paleoanthropological disregard for systematics, for the science of recognizing species and establishing relationships among them. Well, in retrospect, it's possible, I think, for us to recognize this moment of high drama on national TV as the perfect embodiment of a crucial transition, a transition that was actively taking place at the time between an older and a more modern way of understanding the human fossil record. Prior to the discovery of Lucy and her relatives, few paleoanthropologists had ever cared very much about systematics. But after the discovery and the initial analysis of Lucy, the need to have a basic systematic framework whenever you talked about human evolution could never again be entirely ignored. And that new reality, I think, really did symbolize a critical turning point in paleoanthropology. Because the traditional way of doing business had not merely served very efficiently to disguise the inadequacy of Ernst Mayr's gradualist scheme of human evolution. It had also made it possible to cling on to the seductive notion that human evolution had sort of been a heroic and single-minded struggle from primitiveness to perfection, under, of course, the guiding hand of natural selection. But after Lucy had come on the scene, demanding to be fitted into the larger picture, everything had changed. The extra taxonomic space that Lucy created eventually allowed a much more dynamic and actually a much more nuanced also picture of human evolution to unfold. as each new discovery made it harder to ignore the fact that human evolution had not been a simple matter of linear improvement over the eons. Instead, the human evolutionary story had clearly been a complex one of trial and error as new species continuously emerged to explore the many ways in which they evidently are to be a hominin. As the millennia ticked by, many different contenders had been thrust out onto the environmental stage to compete for ecological space with a huge range of challenges that included very close relatives of their own. Now, most of those hominin species undoubtedly perished without issue. But a lucky few were in the right place at the right time and gave rise to descendant species. And the inescapable implication of a history of this kind is that our own species, Homo sapiens, actually acquired its unusual lonely status as the only hominin on the planet through a process of triage, rather than through constant optimization over the eons. And accurately knowing this is actually critical for our own understanding of ourselves today, because a trial and error origin helps us to explain why, after so many millions of years of evolution, we human beings are still such manifestly imperfect creatures. It helps us to explain why, for all of our amazing rational capacities, our individual behaviors are still so murky and often contradictory. And it also tells us, of course, why this elusive human condition of ours is so much more easily observed by poets than it is to be explained by scientists who still have a massive job ahead of them. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.